take number one with Peter Avery in Cambridge. Voilà. Now we could start from the very beginning of how you got interested in fashion studies and got involved in fashion.
I originally became interested in fashion studies in northern India, really. It was in Lahore as the guest of Khan Bahadur Muhammad Shafi. He was a great orientalist.
And when was that?
He showed me Persian manuscripts. That was in 1943, during the war, when I was an officer in the Navy, serving in India. I loved Urdu and realized, of course, the strong Persian components in that language, and was led on from that to an interest in Persian poetry, which Indian Muslim friends used to talk to me about, particularly the poetry of Hafiz. And I determined in the first instance to learn Persian entirely for the purpose of reading this poet Hafiz, translations of whose works I was shown. So Hafiz took me into Persian, really, and I think that at the end it will still be Hafiz that I'm reading just as I start to shuffle off this mortal coil. But I still find Hafiz absolutely entrancing as quite one of the most fascinating and varied poets and demonstrators of the Iranian genius imaginable. I came back, therefore, after the war, before going into the services in 1942, I'd been reading English, and the idea was that I should major in English literature. I'd also done French and medieval history, but I was particularly interested in English literature. On returning from the war and being demobilized from the Navy, I told everybody that I wanted to do Persian and Arabic, and it was for that reason that I went to the London School of Oriental and African Studies, where I read Persian under Professor Lambton. I was hardly aware that Persian was taught anywhere else. I went rather precipitously to the School of Oriental Studies because I didn't realize that Persian could be taught, could be learnt at Oxford and Cambridge. Had I thought more carefully about it, I think I would have preferred to read Persian at Cambridge, where I now myself teach it. But I didn't, in fact, go to Iran until August 1949. That was the month I arrived in Iran for the first time. Having completed my degree at the school, the Oriental School, in Arabic and Persian, I was offered a job as supervisor language training in the oil fields of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. And that job entailed teaching Persian, or being responsible for organizing the teaching of Persian, the Persian language, to expatriate staff, and also being responsible for organizing English classes to the Iranian labor. And this was quite a large program. I was also responsible for educational liaison between the company and the local Iranian government educational authorities for the schools which were operated in the various oil producing areas in the oil fields of southern Iran. And I arrived at Abadan, the big refinery town, which received the oil from these fields for refining and export. One afternoon in August 1949, I can't remember the precise date. What I do remember is stepping out of the aeroplane into an oven-like atmosphere of great heat. And I've always been fond of the dry heat, so I was quite exhilarated by this great heat.
Excuse me, who sent you?
I was employed by the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. My paymasters were the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, and I was acting in their training department as a supervisor, language training in the fields, and liaison officer between the oil company and the government over the schools that we set up and maintained in the oil areas. And this was a very exciting life, because it did at least get me to Iran, the country, as it were, of my dreams. And I found it very enjoyable being in the oil fields. I was extremely glad not to be in Aberdeen, which was a kind of, to my way of looking at it, industrial encampment, whereas the oil fields were much more, if you like, romantic, topographically much more interesting, in the foothills of the Zagros Mountains, in Bakhtiari country. I occasionally used to go down to Khorramshahr and to Ahwaz at weekends, but the weekends I really remember most happily were the weekends I spent in the ancient city of Shushtar, where we used to go and stay with some Iranians who became friends of mine, and where, among other things, I used to shoot in the lush, rather jungly fields around this ancient city of Shushtar, which in itself, for anybody interested in Islam and in the history of Iran and of Islam, was a fascinatingly historical city with exciting water mills cut in the rocks where the river Karun debouched from the Zagros Mountains onto the coastal plain, and of course provided a force of water which was extremely useful for harnessing for the purpose of operating mills. And but I began to get rather frustrated after about 6 months, because I could see no chance of being permitted to go elsewhere in Iran. I was extremely anxious to visit cities like Isfahan and of course Tehran, the capital. My chance, however, came. Happily, I was asked to act as the guide and interpreter for one of the oil company's training managers who came out from the United Kingdom, and take him to Isfahan and to Tehran, which I was able to do. And in Tehran, I was able to meet Sadiq Hidayat, Sadiq Chubach, Buzurg Alevi, and a number of other of the contemporary literati of Iran, whose works I greatly admired, and who indeed, the three names in particular which I've just mentioned, comprised the major contributors to modern Iranian literature of this century. And I spent a great deal of time with these men in the week or so that I was in Tehran. The training manager from London, whose job, accompanying whom was my task, was extremely indulgent in allowing me time off to associate with these literary men. And it was there that I also became acquainted with Mr. Iran Parast, in his bookshop, Kitab Khane Danish, in Khiabani Saadi. And it was in fact in that bookshop that I first set eyes on Sadiq Hidayat. It was a very peculiar coincidence, really, but that morning I'd asked friends of mine in the oil company, one of whom was Sadiq Chubach, who was working in the oil company, the other was Hassan Razavi, whether they could arrange for me to meet Sadiq. And they said yes, they would arrange it there for the evening, for they saw him every evening. I then left them quite early in the morning and went across to Kiamanisadi, to Iran Perest Kitabkhane Danish, and asked him for editions of Hidayat's writings. And he whispered to me, he said, well, he said, would you like to meet the man himself? I said, oh yes, I am meeting him, said I, rather presumptuously. I said, oh yes, that's all taken care of, I'm meeting him tonight, I said. But he said, you could meet him now if you liked. And I glanced towards the back of the shop, and there was a man in a trilby hat pulled over one eye, large spectacles, looking at the books on the shelves. And I said, is that he? He said, yes, that's Sadiq Hidayat. And Sadiq Hidayat and I began a conversation then, which went
Persian?
On. In no, my Persian wasn't good enough. I used to talk, in those days, I talked with him partly in Persian, partly in French. He didn't know English. It was mainly in Persian, but we helped each other out with French words and expressions from time to time, because of course his foreign language, as was generally the case with cosmopolitan educated Iranians of his generation, his other language was French. And I remember we kept on going, he walking backwards or I walking backwards, as the case might be, round and round the book stacks in this long narrow shop, talking and talking about everything imaginable, Virginia Woolf and all kinds of, but the modern novel, Proust, and I suddenly stopped and said, but I'm amazed that you and I should be able to talk like this on first meeting, within a matter of seconds, that we should begin this conversation and go on as we are doing. It is astonishing to me, I said, because we both come from such radically different backgrounds. And he said, but he said, don't you know the Persian phrase, dil be dil rah darad? And I said, no, I didn't. And I was always in those days the student of the language, jotting down these phrases, proverbs, adages, sayings, which are such an extraordinarily rich element in the Persian language. The whole salt and savor of the Persian language. Out came my little notebook as I wrote down, dil be dil rah darad, the heart finds a way to the heart. He said, that's what it's all about. That's why we can talk to each other as we are doing. And so we carried on. And that was the beginning of a friendship with Sadiq Hidayat, which of course lasted not as long as it might have done, for it lasted until his suicide. This was in 1949, and his suicide in Paris was in 1951. He wrote to me before he left and said that I would never see him again.
Really? Why?
And certainly not in the streets of Tehran. And I wrote back and said that I certainly hoped that I would see him again, and in the streets of Tehran. His presence was necessary in his own country. He was the upholder of a torch, of a flame that the Iranian people needed. It was the flame that Hafiz and Saadi had kept alight, and it was a flame that men like he should be going on keeping alight in the modern world. But he explained again that he was leaving the waste and the filth and the dirt and the degradation of Iran as he saw it at that time for Paris, and that he would never return, in spite of my pleadings that he shouldn't think in such terms, and that I would never see him there again. He didn't in fact say to me that I would never see him at all again. His emphasis was on the fact that he would never again be in Iran. And of course, some months later, I heard from an Iranian friend in Masjid-i Suleiman, the oil field center where I was living, who had heard it on the Delhi radio that the news had been broadcast of Sadiq Hidayat's suicide in Paris in 1951. I very much regret not having been able to keep the letter. It got lost in the travels, the subsequent travels I made. This extraordinary letter he wrote to me about his determination to leave Iran and to leave what he described as in cherki ha, the pasti ha ye inja, this dirtiness and this degradation that is here. This was the vein in which he wrote an extremely bitter letter, written, I may say, just after the assassination of Razam Ara, who was a military officer who had been prime minister of the country for a short while, and who was suddenly assassinated. And I think this assassination signaled to a man of Sadiq Hidayat's acute sensitivity and awareness of Iranian history and life and conditions, signaled to him a sense that the rest was going to be decline and despair somehow. His Razam Ara was his kinsman by marriage, and in spite of what others might argue, I'm quite certain that Sadiq Hidayat was in fact in sympathy with some of General Razam Ara's ideas and ideals.
Did it emerge why Razam Ara was assassinated and who did it? Did it ever come to light?
No, it didn't. Of course, there were many rumors that I was the recipient of, along with other people who were in touch or part of the intellectual and literary scene. Many suspicions about the people who actually manipulated the Fedayeen-e Islam member of the Islamic Crusaders who actually shot him.
But why would they do that? I mean, for instance, later on when they assassinated, like, I don't know, 12 years later, Mansour, they said ostensibly because the price of petrol suddenly had doubled. But I mean, was there any measure that Razam Ara had brought on?
Oh, it's particularly, yes, he was, of course, considered too likely to compromise with the British over the oil negotiations. You see, this was at the time when I think all the supplemental oil agreement was being negotiated, and an attempt was being made to revise the price structure and royalty payments on the southern oil, which was in those days being exploited by the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, a British concern. And Razam Ara was trying to achieve some kind of rational arrangement with the oil company, a revision of their terms with the Iranian government. And of course, many people suspected what they would describe as a sellout, or as they suspected him of being too eager to compromise with the British. The result, of course, what finally did happen was in 1951 that the oil was actually nationalized by the National Front deputies, who obtained a working majority in the Majlis under the leadership of Mohammad Mossadegh, who became Prime Minister. And the oil was nationalized, and a very strong nationalist period ensued. What, looking back on those days in Tehran in 1950, meeting Hidayat and Chubak and Bazour Galavi and others, what does, of course, stand out in my impressions is the enormous freedom that we all enjoyed at that time. And I think that of Chewbacca and Hiddart and Mazur Galavi and Goyim Garamanian, I think his name was, and various other literary people, walking about with me in Khiyabani-Shah, Khiyabani-Islambul, 6 o'clock in the evening, going to cafes and bars in that area, talking, arguing, with complete and utter freedom. There was a complete lack of restraint in our conversations and in our activities. This was the last, these were the last days, did we but know it, of course we weren't aware of the fact at the time, these were the last days of that freedom that had been known in Iran since the abdication of Reza Shah and during the war. The freedom of newspapers, of political expression and so on, to a very high degree for a country like Iran.
I would love to actually dwell on that for a little while because of its implication for what comes later. When you went to Tehran finally to interpret for this high-ranking official, you had already read some of the writings of these people. And
oh
got
yes,
in
of
touch
course.
With them,
yes,
just straightforwardly got in touch with them.
Yes, that's right. That's all. Yes.
And there was, as you say, a tremendous literary and journalistic activity at the time.
Tremendous.
It was the beginning of a kind of free democratic society.
That's right.
Which a lot of people today say, if it had continued that trend, it would have been a very healthy development. I mean, that's
yes.
what the Poor Shah desired, which was for Iran to become like a sort of Western democracy,
yes.
would have been achieved. Whereas the clampdown that came later as a result of all the chaos that ensued, it halted that process
yes.
and frustrated the intellectuals and to a larger degree contributed to the developments afterwards.
Yes.
What do you think about the whole of that era? I mean,
well, at that time, the actual freedom was remarkable. Of course, there was a great deal of anxiety on the part of people like Sadiq Hiddart about the state of society. He insisted on taking me himself to southern Tehran to see people who were living like troglodytes in old
hovels
and old brickworks and so on, living in the underground and so on, in conditions of appalling poverty. He said it was very important. I remember his putting it like this. He said, you as an Orientalist and a student of Iran and of Iranian literature, this too, he said, this too, in ham, juzbe, ta'limu tarbiyati shema pa'ad basha, this too must be part of your education, to see the squalor and filth in which so many of us have to live, the awful poverty of southern Tehran. But this was not being paraded to me as something specially Iranian. This was poverty, of which there is a great deal all over the world. And we could discuss it and the iniquity of it quite openly without suddenly being arrested for criticizing any particular government or other. So that there was a considerable amount of political freedom. We also could go into cafes and have conversations and so on without having to glance over our shoulders to see whether the other table behind us was full of informants or not.
Which were the cafes that were frequented by
the intelligentsia? I can't remember their names. It was mostly on Avenue Shah and Islambul, particularly Shah, around about the crossroads where Lalezar is crossed by, or was crossed,
James Lawley,
by Nadiri in Islamabad, and down to Maidan-e Mukhbir-e-Saltani on the one side, and Firdosi, Khiyabani Firdosi on the other. That's where we used to walk, and Lalezar too was one of the areas. But it was mostly in that area of Nadri Shah where the cafes, the bistro was one place I remember we went to. It's called the bistro. And but of course Tehran changed completely. All that kind of character of sort of characteristic of finding a kind of cosiness, a kind of urban cosiness in certain favourite haunts, certain favourite restaurants. Jahayi Dinch, Vistula, cosy little spots where men of like minds and one heart could meet at given hours. Certainly 6 o'clock in the evening was a favourite. And swap the news, drink vodka or beer or both, and joke with each other, have sandwiches and so on. Really a very sophisticated way of life, which was both Iranian and Parisian, both Persian and French. Said Sadiq was not a member of that, but Said Sadiq Goharin.
He
was a friend, but he was one of those whom we went to see in their houses. Some of us were those who went onto the streets at nights, the early part of the evening, and visited the bars and restaurants. Sadiq Haddad always, Chubak invariably, Bazaar Galavi often. Then the question would arise as to whose house we went to for dinner. Haddad himself would pose the question, now, tonight, to whose house are we going for dinner? Or he'd say, what has so-and-so, what have you got for dinner? Or what has so-and-so got for dinner? And of course it was a tacit, the arrangement, there wasn't a roster arrangement. I mean, it was always really planned that the dinner would be at such and such a person's house, because the dinners when you arrived there were always obviously very carefully prepared. Dinners that had been cooking for many hours and been long in their preparation, because they were generally delicious meals. Now, people like Said Sadiq Goharin and others were the sort one visited in their houses. They didn't meet so much in the streets. One would go to the house of so-and-so. Perhaps after a meal one would go on to a meeting, because of course Iranian society was always, and I hope and presume still is, a collection of dore, of circles, you see, and this was really a circle that I was in with these men. And what was the name of the Baba, what was the name of the politician who started the Toilers Party about their times? You know, a new political party is being made, and I remember meeting I became quite friendly with the leader of the Toilers Party, the Hezbi Kargeran. What was the name of that politician who came from Kerman, originally. He was one of the interesting people I met.
Well, to go back to what we called for the time being the Parisian circle, like Hedayat and Chubin and Chubak and Bozor Galavi. Now, wasn't Bozor Galavi one of the old Tudor party?
Yes, he'd
53
been.
That's
people. Right.
And he'd been in jail.
He'd been in jail. Yes.
And generally, the whole. It seems to me that at the time, all of these people were sympathetic, or what we would call fellow travellers, with the Tudor party, weren't they?
I hardly think so. I never believed that Sadiq Haddad, for example, was sympathetic to the Tudor, because I don't think Sadiq Haddad was ever a communist.
None of them were communists. Well, I mean, Bozor Galavi was at some point.
Of course, one must remember that the Tudor certainly had both an appeal to and a backing from good minds and intellects, because the evidence of the Mardum Tudeh Party newspaper points in that direction. Some of the best Persian language, best Persian writing of modern times is in that paper, and of course the highest quality of journalism in modern Iran is manifested by that newspaper. There are some very good minds operating.
On the whole, and intelligentsia in that period, it seems to me, were divided between those who were sympathetic to the Tudor party and those who were sympathetic to the nationalists, to the Mossadegh and so on.
Well, I don't think there was any clear division. What I think was certainly happening at this time, and I'm talking of 1949-1950, what was happening at this time was, I'm actually talking about the winter of 1949 into 50, was an extremely liberal atmosphere was prevailing, and most of the people I was with were what in European terms would be described as liberals. They were people who enjoyed freedom, wanted betterment, wanted improvement of society. They were more, as it were, liberals than any kind of ist or ism about them. But of course the National Front coalesced very rapidly under the pressure of the chance that was being seized to thoroughly to revise the oil agreement, the Anglo-Iranian oil concession. When it suddenly became apparent in 1951 that this concession had to be rescinded and the whole production and marketing of Iran's oil had to be placed on a new footing. Now, under pressure of this, the National Front came into being quite suddenly. The National Front was hardly a factor in 1949. It was just about, it was on the eve of the development of the National Front. Mossadegh in 1949 was not even being talked about. It all happened quite quickly.